What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Badass Fest 2022 edition. Jim and I are here to talk about another great 80s, 90s action film. This is one of the 90s variety. It's Die Hard with a Vengeance. Out in 1995, it was directed once again by John McTiernan, based on a screenplay by Jonathan Hensley, based on the script Simon Says, also by Hensley. Boy, that is an abbreviated version of the story of how this thing got written, which we'll get into, I'm sure. It stars, once again, Bruce Willis returning to reprise his role as John McClane. Jeremy Irons, you've recently seen as Ozymandias in the Watchmen series on HBO. Samuel L. Jackson. No one needs an introduction to Samuel motherfucking Jackson. Michael Christopher, who lately was the CEO of E-Corp for Mr. Robot. And Graham Greene from the Twilight Saga, The Green Mile, Dances with Wolves, etc. Jim, this is the third Die Hard movie, the second sequel. What do you think of Die Hard with a Vengeance?
Die Hard with a Vengeance is pretty good. It's pretty good. I think it's Die Hard with a Vengeance has a great premise and a great beginning that I'm not sure it totally lives up to. I finished watching this movie and I'm like, that felt a little bit long. Little bit saggy in places. Mm-hmm. And I was like, surely this is 30 minutes longer than any other Die Hard to date. And I went and I looked, and it's actually only the second longest. Die Hard 2, I think, is even longer than this by, you know, a
seriously?
Die Hard 1 is like 4 minutes shorter. So it's not significantly longer than either of the others. In fact, it's shorter than one. So I don't know why this feels like it drags in places, but it definitely does. That said, I think Sam Jackson, I mean, he's obviously incredible, and this is back in his heyday when he was like not quite a meme and he was just doing his thing. And it's like straight off the back of Pulp Fiction, right? That was a year earlier. And their chemistry together is great. And he alone makes this movie worth watching, even if Bruce Willis wasn't in it. But having both of them together in this makes it a ton of fun.
Gosh, I wonder if I watched a director's edition of this, because the cut that I saw was 2 hours and 35 minutes with credits on Apple TV.
235?
And I remember thinking distinctly, I don't remember this thing feeling so damn flabby around its middle section. Because like you said, the first hour of this film is tight, uh-huh. Tuco tight. And then I think the film ends fairly well. Although I've got some notes on that too. I think this film is easily the best Die Hard sequel, but the problem with all the Die Hard sequels is they all have kind of a fatal flaw, or at least a significant flaw. And I think this movie is, as we'll discuss, I'm sure, in the writing process, this movie is like three or four different action films Frankenstitched mm-hmm. together.
Yeah.
And then since those plots were largely thrillers and not necessarily action films, they then added action set pieces to it. Huh. And I feel like there is at least one big action set piece that needs to be cut from this film. I would suggest all the tunnel stuff.
All the tunnel stuff. Oh, man.
All the tunnel stuff.
One of the best shots in the movie, which is Bruce Willis shooting up.
Getting blown through a man.
600 feet up a pipe.
Yeah. Okay. You're saying best. I'm saying, because like, to me, what makes Die Hard is a normal dude who just barely by the seat of his pants survives this stuff. Like, Bruce Willis is playing John McClane much more closer to like how Harrison Ford plays, you know, Han Solo and Indiana Jones. This is a guy who's just like kind of surprised he's surviving this stuff himself. Yeah. But he's what's he going to do? Let the Let the Nazis have the cup of Christ. Fuck no. So he keeps fighting. This movie gets into like atomic explosion fridge survival territory. You know what I mean? Just like Indiana Jones can push that concept too far. I felt like him getting blown out of the tunnel was like, damn, yeah, you cut everything where the trucks go into the tunnel, and then you cut right after he gets blown out of the thing, and the movie is the better for it. Because I that stuff is starting to be, you know, I don't know. Because like the thing is, let's zoom out at a meta level and talk about John McClane's place. Or I guess Bruce Willis's place in The Badass, because he is a flagrant contrary example of the first C, the champion. Bruce Willis is not a physical champion. He's not necessarily an opposing figure when he's imposing figure when he's walking down the street, especially in the first Die Hard. So can we talk about that second C, the charisma? Because I think this is the first badass movie we've ever considered with a star that kind of epitomizes that.
Yeah, no, he does. It's kind of why there's a third C on our badass rankings in the first place, because he is just so much fun to watch. And I don't know if he comes up with these lines during the movies, or Bruce Willis, or if they were actually scripted or workshopped with the director or what, but every time he calls this guy a fuckhead, every time he opens his mouth, it's just delightful, right? And he's not really charming the people on screen, because they all think he's an asshole. He's charming the viewer, and yes. I find that just irresistibly fun.
Yeah, in real life, when people have us bent over a barrel and they have us in a compromising position and we're afraid for our loved ones and the cities we lived in, we have to like behave with a certain amount of composure because we don't want to make the situation worse.
Right.
Bruce Willis gets to live in the world where a guy's like, I need you to jump through a whole bunch of hoops to avoid a terrorist plot. And the whole time he's got middle fingers and fuck yous and shoving things up your ass sideways for this guy. He says all the things we wish we could say in those situations.
Yeah.
You know, Hans Gruber's taking a tower hostage. Fuck you. Mm-hmm. Some ex-military guy's trying to take over airport. Fuck him. Hans Gruber's brother's back for more. Fuck this guy in particular. Like that charisma, that not giving a fuck, that despite not being the biggest, toughest guy in the room, going ahead and kicking ass anyway. That is the second C of charisma. And I think Bruce Willis, and honestly, Samuel L. Jackson out second sees Bruce Willis in his own damn film.
Sometimes, yeah. And I love, it's the extreme confidence, right? Because there are moments in every Die Hard movie where he gets a hold of a radio and he gets the bad guy on the horn and he's like, look, you fuckhead, I'm coming for you, right? Like,
yeah,
I've taken your trucks. Here's exactly where I am. Here's exactly the progress I've made on tracking your ass down. And it's not going to stop me. If you know where I am and what I'm doing, I'm coming for you. I love it.
Yeah, it's great. And that's why, and it's not just Bruce Willis, because that's the thing. It's like we had a whole action movie, you know, hero kind of formula trying to break this down. We realized that a lot of the, you know, action movies that we do love, like the Die Hards, like a lot of Clint Eastwood's work, don't really follow the standard kind of like just a massive mountain of meat with a gun, you know, and like Arnold's kind of like the antithesis of that, because while he's charismatic, it's in a different way than like Bruce Willis is, you know?
Oh yeah. I mean, talk about like scripted. I feel like everything Arnold says has been scripted to the nth degree, right?
100%.
Like none of this feels like it's coming from Arnold. It's all coming from the script. So Bruce Willis, yeah, and Arnold are diametrically opposed in that, but still managed to pull off a 1C because of either the writing or who they are.
And also, like, I think it's fair to say that Arnold, if you were just to judge him by like his early roles, like Commando, like Terminator, like Conan. where he's like monosyllabic, he barely has lines. Like he would almost be, if those three roles are all you had to judge him by, you'd almost have to give him a zero of charisma. He's has a second act where he's much more comfortable with English, much more comfortable acting, and they start leaning into these like weird one-liners and quips and stuff. And him, I think Arnold just is like a likable guy. If you ever see him like interviewed or whatever, it's like he's got this immense amount of charm, and that eventually burns through the roles. Yeah. But yeah, if like you closed the book on Arnold's career in 1985, he'd probably be a 2C badass because he'd be a 1C champion. He'd have the iconic characters even that early in his career, but the charisma would be gone.
Yeah.
Bruce is the opposite, you know, like even at his most jacked, he's lucky to pull up a quarter C, 0.5C. And like that's the other thing in successively in later diehards, they keep on eroding his everyman quality because it's like, you know, they just lean into the fact that he's a fuck up and his ex-wife hates him and his kids kind of hate him and he gets balder and buffer and further away from the John McClane ideal. For my money, I think, you know, every diehard past this is kind of garbage.
Yeah, I don't hate Live Free and Die Hard, the fourth one, which is kind of like the return to Die Hard. I don't hate that. It's over the top, though, in just like a way that a lot of these movies are not.
But, you know, the first Die Hard is a damn near perfect film. Damn near perfect action film. And they just keep on, I feel like, straying further from the light. So, yeah, I just this is a fun one because it allows us to talk about, you know, the other side of the badass coin, the badasses that are not gifted physically. They're not imposing towers of meat, but nevertheless, they manage to kick ass and intimidate people.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Man, like I said, Samuel L. Jackson out McClane's McClane. I think the best line of this whole film is where he says, "Well, you can shove your well laid plans up your well laid ass."
Pretty good.
Yeah, I dig it. They also like Samuel L. Jackson's Zeus is a very selfless and moral character in this film too. Because they established that he has a lot of and they don't deal with it in the film, but I'm certain it's well-earned hostility to white people and whiteness in America. You know, they give us enough, like in the beginning, like he's trying to raise his nephews a particular way, and the last thing he wants to do is try to save the life of a cop, a white cop in Harlem. But he does so, and he says it's to save his community, because if a cop gets killed in Harlem, it's going to be bad news for weeks and months to come. But I think it's just because he's a good guy. Like, he can't stand to see an innocent person be killed or hurt. He actually does care about the city, and he doesn't want to see these madmen destroy it. He has personal stakes later in the movie when it turns out, you know, his nephews are the ones that are being threatened by this by Jeremy Irons. Mm-hmm. I really, really liked his character. And like you said, this is before Samuel L. Jackson became a mega super ooper duper star. This was like hot off the heel of his Pulp Fiction performance. I guess largely on the basis of that, he got this role because Bruce Willis recommended it. They were trying to get Lawrence Fishburne roped into it.
Oh, hmm.
Who also,
that's
by
an
the
interesting movie.
That is an interesting movie. And did you know that Lawrence Fishburne was the first choice to play Jules in Pulp Fiction?
No, really?
Yeah. He according to reports, he turned that down because his agent says, look, if you want, he's wanting to become more of a leading man. He goes, if you just keep taking complimentary guest starring parts, you're never going to get that. So he started turning down anything that did not focus himself as a star. And man, it seems like that's a big mistake.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know, because early Larry Fish, like before The Matrix,
sure,
he definitely has like a Sam Jackson-esque quality to him. You know, it's not quite the patter that Sam Jackson has, but he's got a lot of character. Because I don't know, somewhere along the way, Larry Fish just like changed who he was as far as like what movies he was taking and what characters he was playing, and went from playing like a lot of smack talking dudes to playing like ultra serious people,
cerebral Zen masters.
Yeah,
essentially Morpheus.
Right. And Sam Jackson kind of never did. Sam Jackson.
No,
just,
Sam
like,
Jackson just continued
what he could do the best, and man, it was worth it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I would like to see that cut though, with Lawrence Fishburne in the role.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of fascinating kind of what ifs in this movie. And I guess that's the thing, is like Larry Fish, when he initially turned down the role, but then was kind of I guess hot to get it back after, I forget exactly what the reason, and they'd already given the role to Samuel L. Jackson, and there's a lawsuit, like he accused them of reneging on a verbal commitment, and I guess there's a settlement and all that. But it's a very interesting pop culture question of what if Larry Fish was Jules and Zeus back to back, 94-95. Are we like, do we have snakes on a plane with Larry Fish? Is Samuel L. Jackson the Zen master in The Matrix?
Yep.
it's a really, really interesting thing to ponder.
Yeah.
So like I said, we talked about this the film's shortcomings. The things it's strong at is, again, the first hour of this movie threatens to be a perfect Die Hard film. And some of the really great practical stunt work that they do in terms of like car chases, in terms of like frantic runs through subway tunnels and car trains, in terms of just really uncomfortable social situations that Jeremy Irons has put John McClane into, I think that stuff is top notch. In particular, some of the car chases they do through busy New York streets are unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I would have loved to be the person, the stunt driver who got to drive through Central Park.
Dude,
that looked like so much fun.
How the hell do they get the permission to shut down huge sections of Wall Street, Brooklyn, right, Central Park, and just like they're tearing shit up? They're like doing yard jobs through Central Park, they're vaulting over boulders. I don't know how often they shut down Central Park for this kind of stuff. I know they do, but like this must have been like a big production, and maybe they're just really good at shutting off small sections of the park and making it look, because the other thing is that it looks fully populated. There's the joggers, there's the buskers, there's the families feeding ducks. There's like, and John McClane's plowing through all of them. It's wild.
Are you trying to hit these people? Come on.
Yeah. Well, maybe the mime.
I think that the opening of this movie is incredible. Both the premise here, like what they're forcing Bruce Willis to do, and the way that they bring you in on that, The way that they bring you in on John McClane, I think like having him start the thing with a hangover and he's been, you know, suspended from his job.
What's his status? Yeah.
Right. We don't find out till later, but you know, he hasn't talked to his wife in a year. That is John McClane, the dude in the back of that paddy wagon or whatever. And then they don't waste any time in this movie, right? There's an explosion. He's brought in. He gets out of the truck, puts on the sandwich board, and he's walking down the street. And you're like, what does this thing say? Like the shot of the old woman walking past him on the corner.
Yeah, and a really well dressed.
And you're like, what does it say on this board? And then, you know, we go off for a second to Sam Jackson and out the window, he sees him and we see what it says. And it's like, oh my God, this is terrible. This is horrible. Yeah. I think it's a brilliant opening to this movie and it does stay very good for a while. In retrospect, when I'm thinking about, okay, why does this movie feel overly long? It might be because A, there are too many twists, and you alluded to maybe why that might be. But also, here's the one flaw of this movie. I think it's a mistake to send it. I don't know. Maybe it's not. It depends on the motivation of the main character. If it was never like a revenge story, which I don't think it was, I think this makes more sense. But is it a mistake to send Bruce Willis into a situation where he could be killed and you don't have any control over it if your plan is to distract the police using Bruce Willis as like this
yeah, cover? I had a similar thought.
Control over all of that, right?
Yeah, I had similar thoughts to you because, you know, this is we coincidentally watched this film a couple months ago as a one of our watch party things. And I remember because I like Die Hard with a Vengeance. I think I've always thought it's like the second best Die Hard sequel, or I guess the best Die Hard sequel. But as we're watching it, and this is always a problem with the live watches, you start talking to chat and you're making jokes. And like I was halfway to film, like fully lost. I don't remember why some of this stuff is happening, and I don't know why John McClane is leaping to, you know, the school plot, bombing plot being fake, and a couple of twists, especially at the end, like, holy hell, how are we at this Canadian truck stop? And I'm like, well, it's, you know, when we sat down to watch it, I'm like, well, this will probably make a lot of sense. And I'm sitting down, and yeah, I agree that some of these decisions, like, yeah, what if he was murdered 4 minutes into that and the cops are 10 blocks away and they can't stop it and Samuel L. Jackson wasn't there?
Yeah.
Dude,
only reason he's not there is some dude intervenes, right?
But I think if you either is this a plot hole or is it more cynical and sinister than you think, where Jeremy Irons is like, well, if they kill a white cop in Harlem, every fucking cop in New York City is going to descend upon there and with riot gear, and they're going to be completely consumed with finding the people that slayed their officer, and maybe he wins anyway.
It seems like there's quite a delay between, you know, they might be able to like clean up that mess and get back to Wall Street in time to stop them. I don't know.
And there's also like, I guess that's the other thing is like, it feels like you're supposed to understand that John McClane is it's not his main goal. It's just something that it's like taken upon in passing. It's like, well, I'm here anyway. I'm going to go ahead and fuck with John McClane. If John McClane dies and whether the cops riot, he still has the school plot.
Yeah.
That's going to injure. So it's like, he's got like this nested layer of things, but I think you're right. Like if you look at all the different things in isolation, because I still don't know how he actually got the gold out of the city. Like, at what point, where did the gold go? It was supposed to, it's not on the ship. Those trucks were loaded with scrap metal. Like, they do a lot of sleight of hand where the fake plot you follow to the bitter end, but the actual plot, they kind of get away with not having to explain. He just gets all this shit across the border, no fucking problems. Up in his warehouse, and they're all celebrating. And I thought there's a lot of these things where the different sections of this film don't necessarily connect to each other.
Yeah, they connect better than I remember them connecting, but you're right. The one that doesn't quite connect is how they tricked everybody by swapping the gold out, because their own dude, their second in command or whatever, didn't even know about that, right?
Right. Yeah, he was ideologically pure. He thought that they were actually trying to strike a blow against imperialism and the greedy monetary system. And no, Jeremy Irons is just lying in his pockets.
I don't know. I mean, it also strikes a blow. It's not like there's no blows stricken.
That's true.
You can still keep the gold. I love the scene where Sam Jackson gets his hands on one of those bars. And he's just like, are you fucking... John McClane tells him to put it down and let's go. And he's like, no, there's no way. There would be no force on earth that could pry that gold bar out of my hand. I would not have put it in the backseat. Are you kidding me? It would be
in my
pocket.
Are you talking yourself personally?
Uh-huh.
I thought the same way. And I think I've changed as a person in the 20 years since I've seen this. Because I think I used to think like, yeah, you probably shouldn't steal gold from... And now I'm like, fuck no, steal... You're going to recover $200 billion for these goddamn banks and Wall Street dudes and like the different foreign governments. Like, keep a brick for yourself. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a
absolutely.
Fee.
Yes. And if they want to arrest me for that, then fuck off. I'll bill them for all the trauma. And yeah, no, I was totally on Team Sam, and I was actually.
Yeah.
Because I thought maybe that he got to keep it, but he left it in the Mercedes guys.
Yeah, it went right back to the rich people.
A fucking Mercedes guy gets it.
I know.
Yeah.
Disgusting.
Man. What'd you think about the providential dueling presidential name drops here? You had both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump name checked within 20 minutes of each other in this film.
Wow.
That's black lady exclaiming as if it would be a positive thing, like, yeah, and I'll be marrying Donald Trump.
Right.
And then, John McClane bitching about Hillary Clinton. Thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Donald Trump was just a rich guy in the era of this film.
Just a famous, famous rich dude.
From New York. So, of course, everyone in the city would know him.
Yeah. All right. Do we have any non-spoilery kind of stuff to talk about, or should, because I imagine there's, you know, this is almost a 30-year-old movie. There's probably a lot of people that haven't seen it. Should we kind of give the rundown of what the movie's about and then get into the spoiler stuff? Or
I want to suggest one other cut that would take like 5 minutes out of this movie that could have been good. Uh-huh. I feel like John McClane was sitting on too many tasks. Mm-hmm. If they had cut the second one. Not the one with the sandwich board, but the one where he just goes to the payphone.
Oh, and there's the verbal, the how many guys took how many wives to how many.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like that would have cut down on the runtime of this movie and a little bit of the flab.
Yeah, but then I just hate the water tunnel stuff. Maybe you cut them both. Because there's still, like, even if you did that, there's like five different like Batman Riddler caliber puzzles that you could easily lean on, and I think it worked as fine. Okay. All right, well, I don't want to, because I have tried to keep a few spoilers to myself. So if you're have avoided the Die Hard sequels, or you're one of them young kids that don't know. 1995's Die Hard with a Vengeance. We find this is John McClane after his previous two adventures. He's estranged from his wife. He's off the force. He's suspended. He's living a drunken lout type of lifestyle. And some mad bomber in New York City is singling out him. He needs this guy to do a series of tasks for him across the city where he's going to start blowing shit up. He's blowing up. He opens up by blowing up a department store. He threatens the Federal Reserve. He threatens the New York City public school system. Just causing big old mess. And on his first task, he is sent to Harlem with a racially offensive message scribbled on a sandwich board that he's carrying. And Samuel L. Jackson, a shop owner nearby, takes pity on the man who he assumes is insane and tries to intervene when the whole neighborhood tries to kill him. And they get embroiled in this plot that is it looks like a politically motivated bombing of New York City. And there's lots of twists and turns. And John McClane has to figure out why this is happening, what the villain's actual identity and motive is, and can he do it before hundreds and perhaps thousands of children die in New York City? That's the stakes. Okay, now get out of here if you don't want spoilers. I think a particularly brilliant touch of this movie is the idea that Hans Gruber's brother's back for revenge.
Okay.
And I think Jeremy Irons, even though I don't think his German accent is particularly good, it's highly entertaining. And Jeremy Irons is clearly enjoying being this diabolical, amoral East German asshole. I love everything about Jeremy Irons' performance, and I think it compares favorably in the kind of like scenery chewing style that Hans Gruber established in the first one.
Yeah. No, I agree. He's an excellent choice for this role. You say his German accent isn't very good. I would also say his American accent is not very good. Especially his Southern American accent. I don't know what he's trying to pull off there, if that's Texas or what. But it's
not great. it's very, very bombastic. It's wild. I thought that in the first movie, Alan Rickman did a passably good American accent.
Yes.
You know, for a guy that's under stress and strain.
Mm-hmm, as I recall, but I it's been a little while.
Especially since like the whole there's this explanation for why these Eastern Bloc Germans are so good at speaking English, and they mention that they're from a like East German counterintelligence force that was specifically trained to have perfect, flawless English accents so that they could do infiltration work and stuff like that. That's a pretty interesting idea. But Jeremy Irons, this Texas oil man thing he's trying to do.
Yeah, it would not fool me.
And the suit he's wearing this like skinny suit, which fair. He's a skinny, lanky guy. Mm. He's got his suit pants tucked into his combat boots.
No.
And he's wearing this long, skinny tie that's an apple hanging on a string. It's bizarre. It's it all adds up to like, I can't believe that the police are just like, oh, yeah, this guy. He's from city. He's here. It stretched my credibility, my credulity.
For sure. But other than that, yes, he's excellent. I find him appropriately menacing throughout this movie. I think he's great at the like. I don't even know what to call it. Every time he gets on the phone with McClane, he's great at like keeping it all business in a way that tells you he's in control.
Do you know why they brought up the stuttering plot?
Well, it's a fake out. It's
a fake out for what?
To make them believe that he is on this revenge mission against John McClane personally, when in fact he doesn't care all that much about it.
Is that true? Because I actually got the distinct opinion that that might be secretly the thing he cares most about.
Nothing I saw in the movie says, like, you know, when it all comes out in the wash, that he actually cared about that at all. His brother he does that, you know, fake stutter at the end, which with the gullible stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, all that to me is just fake.
The movie wants us to think that, yeah, because he at the end is like based on the gullibility of the New York City's finest. But I don't know, like what was the stakes there? If their criminal profiler is like, well, he doesn't have a stutter, so clearly he's more interested in revenge than perhaps stealing any large amount of gold. Like the cops have no idea what his true motivations for doing anything are throughout the entire film. So like, mm-hmm. I felt like that was played as a moment of triumph. Like, I got those suckers. But like, if he hadn't stuttered, what's the criminal profiler say? I thought that was, there's a couple things I felt like didn't connect really well, and that was one of them.
Gotcha. Yeah, there's still plenty to go on to say that this guy wants revenge.
Yeah. They had a whole bunch of fancy, like this, the binary liquid. I thought that was a pretty interesting way to tell the story because it gives a visual, an interesting visual thing. Usually bombs like have a timer and then they go off and they explode. This has got this like gray area where the timer's gone off and you see the liquid mixing and eventually it's going to become a highly, but you've got some, I thought that was a really visually interesting way to tell like a slow moving explosion and still let the hero have some kind of agency over the bomb after it's already quote unquote got off or gone off. I thought that was, a really nice twist that added a lot of suspense to some of these bomb scenes.
Yeah, and visually how these bombs just keep getting bigger and bigger, right? And it just results in like two larger vials to where you're on the boat and they're like bigger than a human being, right?
Yeah.
They're just these enormous vials.
It's like a micro brew operation at like a a small brewery.
The most ridiculous part of this movie, in my opinion, the most insane thing is the explanation of that bomb, the demonstration scene to let us as an audience member know how dangerous these bombs are, because you've got the Charlie, who is like their bomb defusal expert, their bomb expert.
Yep.
And he brings a suitcase bomb into the chief of police, the captain, his office, along with all his other, like his deputies and his assistants. And like, this is the active precinct. He just brings a fucking bomb in and then actively mixes it and throws it into just like the precinct and blows up a chair. How is he not fired?
Charlie is a total asshole. Yeah, this is some reckless ass behavior. And it's punching. Insane. And the way he mixes is he's punching holes into the containers that can hold the lid. But at the end of this movie, he's revealed to be a fool because, you know, he's betting his life on he's the one that can stop this bomb from exploding. No, he can't. Like, if this was an actual bomb instead of a pancake topping, you'd been dead, Charlie, you dumb asshole.
Yes, but I think Charlie is also a hero. Charlie is a hero for the decisions he makes.
How?
Maybe not for his ability or skill. Because he makes the decision to stay in that school when he knows that there are still kids in there and try and defuse the bomb, even if it means his death. That's heroic.
Yeah, I guess it is. I just think it's one of those things where it's like, if I with no bomb training had been like, I'm gonna stay and try to defuse this bomb.
Yeah, you're an idiot, but you're still a hero.
Am I? Because like, I feel like that Charlie is in that phase where he's just snipping wires. He's maybe it explodes early. Maybe it kills.
You're right.
And yeah, he's. But I want to springboard off of this because the previous two Diehards are one of their hallmarks. Is the absolute dysfunction of their police departments and the cooperation between different city departments and federal and state and local authorities. It's a goddamn shit show. Mm-hmm. This movie, the NYPD is played as fairly competent, fairly, you know, pragmatic. When the FBI show up, you think it's going to be a shit show. It turns out one of the FBI agents has kids at one of these schools and they're all like, well, what do you need from us? There's going to be no jurisdictional fight. And I'm like, why the turnaround? I think it's because these previous movies, John McClane was the NYPD police officer in the head up its ass LAPD police department on the West Coast. And God knows what they think about the Philly police department. But like, I think in the Die Hard universe, NYPD is just a shining paragon of police work.
Seems like it. Yeah.
Cause like, yeah, if John McClane's one of them, on his best day, then they're all John McClane's, I guess.
Kinda. Yeah. And they still get bamboozled. You know, it's not like they're clairvoyant or anything, but yeah, they seem pretty competent at their job. And I like how, is it the chief of police? I don't know who this guy is. The captain.
Yeah. Of his precinct.
Sure. Yeah. The captain. I like how every time John McClane calls him up and says like, hey, I've got new information. The guy like scrambles to try and help him out. Right. It's not like Die Hard 2. Where, you know, Frank, what's his name? The guy from, it's NYPD Blue guy, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That guy's telling him to stick it up his ass every other scene.
Right. I don't know how you do it up in New York, pal, but here in Philly, yeah.
Yeah. So I did appreciate that. Like, John McClane is, you know, he's a suspended cop, but he's still respected in the force and by his superiors.
And that they seem to have all their shit together, and they're not particularly they're not more interested in interdepartmental pissing contests than they are with, like, saving lives, maintaining order. Yeah. Fabulously optimistic look at the police agency, but I think that's the movie's the viewpoint. I want to talk a little bit more about Sam Jackson's Zeus character. I saw in an interview that Sam Jackson said, now this was back just, I think, when the movie was released, but he said that this role is the closest to his actual personality of anything that he's ever done on film before. Now, it could just be, like, Sam Jackson being Sam Jackson.
Or the way he speaks to people, or...
That's he didn't elaborate, but I think you got to say it in probably take it in totality. And that's sure. The thing that because that's the thing. There's this scene where, you know, Samuel L. Jackson has just given this, like, you know, pro-black speech to his nephews about how, you know, you gotta watch out for yourself and you gotta take care of yourself and no one's ever going to help you, especially not white folk. And then he sees this apparently crazy black white guy out here with the "I hate N-words" placard on. And there's a scene where it reminds me a lot of that scene in, like, The Expanse, where Holden, like, Monica calls him about a lead with the protomolecule, and he's, has a vow to, like, stay out of this business because, you know, nothing ever good for him. And he, like, focuses in and he goes, like, God damn it, because he knows he's going to get sucked into it, because he can't just stand by and let something terrible happen. That's what Samuel L. Jackson's on his face when he's like contemplating. He's like, this is my neighborhood, this is in front of my shop. If I intervene for this crazy white guy, I might, and he even later in the movie says, like, these guys are probably, instead of killing you, they're burning down my shop. He is putting himself out to protect, in his neighborhood, the out group. And I think that, you know, if you want to talk about Charlie's heroics, I think his heroics, especially in the face of John McClane's obtuseness about racial justice in America, that's the thing that feels very dated in this film, that, like, John's finally like, hey, come on, what, Zeus, why are you making all this racial? Right. Man, why you always got to make things about race, Zeus? Like, yeah, it feels. And at the end of it, there's a little bit of, Sam learning to stop worrying and loving the white guy and being more focused on his marriage. And there's a little of that kind of seep. But yeah, Zeus, as portrayed in this film, is a pretty, pretty righteous, heroic dude. And
yeah, absolutely. But to a point, right? He's also not, like, the dude who wants to risk his own life when the situation doesn't call for it, and he gets tricked into it at some point.
Yeah. Yes, he is nobody's fool and he's nobody's sucker.
Yeah.
But he also is, like, what gets him sucked into it is his own mouth. Like, that well-laid plans up your well-laid ass is when Jeremy Irons, like, okay, fucker, now you're it as well. Oh, that's another potential plot hole. When I was watching this film, I'm like, later in, you need almost two guys assigned to all these riddles and tasks. Does this imply that Jeremy Irons was kind of improvising the entire time, because he didn't know that Sam Jackson was going to show up and start taking an interest in these adventures from the beginning, right?
Right, right. And I don't think he had time to redesign his riddles on the fly when he realized, right, oh, there are actually two dudes here. I'm struggling to come up with the riddle that needed two people, though. Which, what would you say it is?
I thought that they were doing a lot of, like, splitting up and, like, covering different ground, and, you know, like, well, you go to the phone while I go to the bomb, and you drive here.
But it's all in an effort to thwart their plan, right? Like, Jeremy Irons doesn't want them splitting up.
Okay.
He expects, like, John McClane to just follow his plan because he has no option.
The other thing is, John McClane turns out is dumb as hell. But it turns out that these logic puzzles, and he would be I feel like the jig would be up very quickly, that all these bombs are kind of, although the subway one's not, the subway one, they needed to go off, because if it didn't, the rest of their plan fizzles. That was the one that was the linchpin.
Is that the one that sets off the alarms at the bank?
It sets off the alarms of the bank. It provides the damage where they can go in and drive the, you know, it blows a hole in the thing, so they have direct access to the tunnels, and it, also sets off the alarm, so they're ignoring their seismic sensors and stuff like that.
Yeah. I think you're right. The other ones you could probably excise, but you know, you want a few of them, right? You don't just want two things that he has to do and then boom, we're off to the races with the twists. So yeah, I don't know. I have a hard time saying what I would cut out of this movie, but probably one of those. I liked all the riddles, though. I think the riddles were good, you know?
Yeah, no, all of them.
They were too simple. I remember during the watch party that we did of this movie, mm-hmm. we were trying to entertain and we were trying to watch the movie at the same time. And mm-hmm. both of us, when the scene comes up with the 3-gallon jug and the 5-gallon jug, we're mm-hmm. desperately trying to figure that out. And we yeah. absolutely could not. We did not come to a conclusion. So when it came up kids. This time, I fucking sat down and I figured it out because I was not going to have a repeat of the watch party.
And the thing is the film itself doesn't. The film
comes
in halfway through the solution. So they've already got the 2 gallons in one of the things. And now, yeah. There's two different ways to do it. Yeah, like lets you play at home if you want, uh-huh. I guess.
Totally.
I thought it's an odd choice. It's kind of like, how would you feel about like a National Treasure, which is a movie about the puzzles, uh-huh. if they left out the middle part of a solution? I don't know.
Pretty shitty.
I felt like it was a little shitty to not, but also it's this. Yeah, I think the average person, if you have a minute or two to think about it, can come up with a solution. Now, gun uh-huh. to your head. Right. All the children in New York City taken hostage. That's a different matter. But
bomb juice mixing. Yeah, I'm not sure under that pressure that I could, but it was fun to figure it out. I like riddles.
Yeah, man, there is some insane practical stunt work. We talked about the yes. road stuff that they do, the park stuff that they do. I thought that like it felt to me a lot of that stuff they're doing with the subway, maybe it's sped mm-hmm. up footage, but like I think they actually have stuntmen like jumping through hatches on the trains. There's actually a train going right past them. That stuff seemed extremely dangerous and extremely exciting when you're watching it.
Yeah, no, I really love that scene. I love even how artificial it feels and looks when they have the train come off the tracks in the station mm-hmm. when John McClane throws the bomb out the back. It feels like you're going to Universal Studios and getting on the King Kong ride or something, right? Where there's big mechanical thing happening.
Uh-huh.
I can feel in those scenes the effort it took to get that stunt done.
Yeah.
Just because of how artificial it looks. Because if it was all CG, it'd be like, well, some dude sat at a computer for 15 hours sure. and made this all happen. But I don't know. I love those practical effects.
And I guess it was terrifying on set because that, like you said, it's fake and that Universal where you can tell there's like tracks and rails and it hits this point and it does. Uh-huh. But that thing was moving legit 45 miles an hour when it derails. Yeah.
Seriously?
And like, I guess like if you look at some of the stuntmen, they look like they're terrified running from it. And they said there's like you didn't need much acting because, yeah, if you didn't hit your mark and get the fuck out of the way, it was quite capable of killing people.
Jeez.
But they just the scale of that set, like you had to build a whole goddamn subway yeah. station and then rig that thing to explode and pop off and do a fugitive. And another the other thing I thought were really brilliant is like usually they do a good job of, because that's the other thing is like everything in Die Hard is kind of tongue in cheek and funny. So like we got this really stressful situation of John McClane trying to find his bomb on the train. You've also got Zeus trying to get in a taxi cab and picking up this obtuse, you know, Wall Street guy who wants to go, and he's given the reverse racism shit to Sam and that like look on like, oh, you want a ride? Mm-hmm. And we don't see the ride that he took over there. All we see is this guy's terrified face in the back seat when Samuel comes, you know, he comes screaming up and just bails on the taxi, and they show the payoff of that. This guy's just sitting in the back seat with his. I thought that stuff is good. It's like it's got the tension, but it's also got the humor that's constantly kind of, you know, preventing this from becoming like a fugitive where it's a serious action thriller. Right. It keeps it steady in that mid-80s, mid-90s zone.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that is Die Hard, right? It's the foul-mouthed action set pieces. Because there aren't a lot of movies like this, strangely enough, right? Like, mm-hmm. you can go to Lethal Weapon, you can go to some of the Shane Black stuff and see, like, a similar vibe, but I really think like Die Hard has a unique combination of action, thriller, and just the vulgarity that is inserted in there, like, separates it from the pack.
I agree. The other thing there's constantly in this movie, John McClane's like driving through Central Park and he's calling that's another brilliant thing where he calls an ambulance to kind of plow the road for him. Mm-hmm. Why don't the cops ever follow him? Like, they get to when they see him go through Central Park, it's like, they're like, almost like, well, we can't follow him. Like, why don't they?
Yeah, I don't know that it would be any more dangerous to have 7 cop cars come through. The first one is the dangerous one, right?
And maybe even less dangerous if you turn on your sirens and you start, the cab doesn't have any of that. It's just a sedan barreling through without any kind of herald. If you get the cops getting people to look in that direction, maybe it's safer. But they're like, oh, damn, we can't possibly drive through Central Park.
There's some line that Jeremy Irons says about you have to use civilian transportation on one of these challenges. I think it's a Central Park challenge.
McClane does, but McClane the rest
does.
Of the... Yeah, maybe that would be seen as cheating. Yeah.
Maybe, but then how is the ambulance not cheating? Because to me, it's... like, using your powers as a cop, your credentials as a cop, is what is the problem. Although he uses it to commandeer the taxi. I don't know. I don't know where the line is.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. And I guess there's also I don't think Hans is monitoring any of his communications. So
Hans is dead.
I'm sorry. Whatever the Elder Gruber.
Yeah, I don't know his name either.
Peter
Gruber.
Simon. No, Simon Gruber.
Simon Gruber.
Because he's actually Simon. Simon says. Which I thought that was a cool thing too. That Simon says, and it pays off with them thinking there's a bomb that's going to go off and kill him. And he's like, I didn't say Simon says. I also liked how smooth Simon's operation was here, but it also stretched my belief because it seemed like that he had, and maybe I missed something, but it seemed like he had the NYPD infiltrated. He had the Federal Reserve infiltrated. He had the city public works department infiltrated. He had handpicked guys that were on the scene that would already how the hell did he? It's one of those things where it's so complicated a plot. You think, how the hell do you pull this off with 20 people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. Having plants and locations is tough. It says that their vetting is not very good, first off. And secondly, it says that the plan has been in place for a long time, because you can't just get people hired and in these positions in a week. It would probably take years to plan this. Which it's a big heist, so it probably did take years.
Yeah, I mean, Ocean's 11, they only had to get Bernie Mac at the deal cards. That was the one thing that they had to do from the inside. This has got 17 different moving parts with 23 different plants. It's a lot.
Some of the other stunts I like and really appreciate is that 360 spin that he does in the car when he's being chased later on in the movie, and while he's shooting out the window at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That was super awesome, and it felt very real, maybe this could actually happen. I mean, the shooting as you're spinning I don't even know if Keanu Reeves could do that, but It's a very cool stunt, and it was clearly all done, practically. Oh, the Mercedes going
the Mercedes
off
jump
the ledge. Yeah, that's clearly on wires, but
it's clearly on wires. You can't see them, but the trajectory of the car flying off looks extremely unnatural.
Totally.
Maybe you could cut that. And even though I hate the tunnel sequence, I think that's the one that feels like it's really draggy. Because there's also this, there's a 2-minute exposition scene where they arrive to the construction of these tunnels. And, John McClane has this screaming exposition match with this tunnel guy where it's like, oh, yeah, the tunnels go all the way up to Taz. It's 60 miles up to Yonkers. And it goes up to, and just goes on and on and on talking about this tunnel project, which, did you know, 20 years later, 25 years later, they are still building this fucking tunnel.
60 miles. That's it. Really?
They started this project. This is supposed to be so New York City built their first tunnel to get water into the city because there's too many people drinking it to get it out of the Hudson River, I guess. In 1915, they built a secondary tunnel in 1930. They commissioned this tunnel in 1970, broke the ground for it. It's still under construction and it's not scheduled to be completed until 2026.
Wow. Doesn't New York have you a history of this?
I don't. I mean, I'm sure it's a complex. It's a complex project to dig a like 70 mile tunnel that's 26 feet and wide, and it's going under the ocean. It's going under Manhattan. It's going under Central Park. It's doing like all these really complicated things. But still, 50 fucking years. Didn't they build a tunnel underneath the English goddamn Channel in like two decades?
Did they?
Can we get the French over here to dig Le Tunnel because we need help? I don't know, but yeah, you could do Die Hard 6 in the tunnels and in these under construction tunnels because they still ain't carrying water.
Yeah,
yeah, I would cut that entire scene. I don't know, and like I'm trying to think of like.
Well, it's important because it tells you like exactly how they're going to escape the tunnels, and it's a lot of exposition that is like. Secondarily important, right? Because he could just follow them into the tunnels and we don't really know how he's going to get out or anything, but it sets up like John McClane's escape later through these, you know, once every 2 miles they have an air shaft or whatever. And it also sets up like where they might be getting out of this tunnel 20 miles in.
I'm saying you just don't do the tunnel. You do some kind of like Italian job situation where you've got fake dump trucks that are like leading the cops to somewhere else. And secretly they just led. Cause I feel like in actuality, they did get in, eventually drive these trucks onto a flatbed and then drove them onto a boat. And just like the tunnel just seemed like a little bit gilding the lily. And I don't know. I'm just looking for like 20 minutes to cut. I thought, and like, that's where I started thinking this is too much because everything just kept on getting more and more complicated. Like, okay, he's figured out the 14 and he's followed them into the tunnel. And then, goddamn, the bridge breaks, you know, the steel plate falls and John McClane. And I'm like, well, God damn, do we have to complicate every freaking thing that's going on in this movie? And I was getting kind of bored and restless. And then I thought that immediately after the tunnel scene, the movie picked up again. And I think the ending is a bit of a mess, but I think I understand why. But yeah, the tunnel, I just hate the tunnel part. Everything in the tunnel, that 20 minutes, I think is easily excisable.
I think it's entertaining. I really like Jerry, the truck driver who should be on Jeopardy.
For his tunnel history, his encyclopedic tunnel history.
Yeah. He's like a tour guide here. It's kind of fun. I really love John McClane surfing the truck and then being shot out 600 feet of pipe. just happening to land exactly where Sam Jackson is driving by at that exact moment and where the bad guys can see them and shoot at them.
That's the stuff where I feel like Die Hard is becoming a little like Arnold. That's something that Arnold could do. It's like kind of James Cameron True Lies thing. I don't know. Like I think that John McClane can survive that shit?
I mean, can he survive? The bigger ask to me is that he survives the climb down the cable on the winch on the truck.
Oh, God. They're taking their sweet ass time doing it, too, by the way.
I know. They're looking back. They're having a conversation while they're climbing down this thing.
Yeah, they're trying to solve racism in America. like maybe slide when they get like, oh, when you get some gloves. I thought they're going to like do some kind of sliding thing, but they're like hand over handing it.
Yeah, there's no way. And
oh, my God, they fall like 80 feet on the steel. That's what I'm saying. All this
survive that.
That shit is just too, like, John McClane is always supposed to barely survive things, and I thought that they've done a pretty good job. Like, this all started in the last Die Hard, where he pulls the ejection seat.
On the grenade scene.
This started, that's a system designed to convey a human being to the ground safely in that type of situation, right? So it's like, okay. But this is just, it's Wile E. Coyote shit. And yeah. I don't know. It was a step too far. I think they cut the tunnel and they cut the honestly Samuel's idea of jumping onto that little tower. Uh-huh. That yeah, it's a tough jump, but if you make it, you're fine.
Sure. God, I can't imagine trying it. I mean, it's not even like it's a solid platform you can land on. It's like
a crane boom
and and lattice work of metal. It's that would be terrifying.
Yeah, but it would be in suspenseful and like it's just be like, you know, I'm gonna jump. They like, you know, holding hands and doing a Thelma and Louise kind of thing. I think the cable just was dumb.
Let me ask you this about Die Hard 2. In that grenade scene where he, so to set it up, like he's in the cockpit of this plane and the bad guys are outside and they're trying to shoot him and they can't shoot him. So they all like take 25 grenades and throw them into the cockpit with John McClane inside. And he gets in the ejector seat. He ejects out of a commercial airplane. I'm not even sure that you can do this. Does the canopy
it was a military off? Transport it was a military was transport okay. that's how they because okay. I always thought that too
commercial airliner,
what fucking Boeing or McDonnell Douglas airliner has ejection seats for the pilot and why are they never used like
anyway so he ejects out the top of this and I think what happens I'm not sure ejector seats are designed to be fired on the ground and let you fall safely. I think you need more space than that, like when you're base jumping, right? It's always dangerous because you don't have much space between you and the ground for your parachute to take effect. I think what happens in that scene is he is blown to safety, right? Like the grenades give him the boost he needs to get the height where the parachute will be effective. Or am I reading too much into that?
I know that there are some rocket-assisted ejection seats that are designed to get you clearance from something or other, and if this transport has those type of things, and if I think some of them are designed to where yes, they would get you to a safe height above the ground for your parachute to deploy and all that kind of stuff. We probably talked about this. Like we've got coverage of the other Die Hard films. I think they're locked behind the paywall. But if you're a club member, feel free to look up the you know Christmas stuff or you know just search Bald Move Die Hard and you can listen to our takes. I imagine we probably have to discuss that.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. Probably. And I bring it up here to talk about the other incredible blown to safety moment in this movie.
Yes. Yeah. Bring it up.
It's maybe the most egregious example of blown to safety I've ever seen. Because the characters involved are kind of stupid. They run to the back of the boat. So the blown to safety moment is when they're on the boat, they've picked the lock, they've escaped. There's this huge bomb that's going to go off to destroy and sink all the gold, right?
Mm-hmm.
Though we know the gold isn't actually on the boat. and they get loose and they're running for their lives, and they run off the back of the boat for some reason instead of just jumping directly into the water. If you know anything about the insulating properties of water from like shockwaves and kinetic energy, you want to be in that water ASAP. I would go right off the side of that boat. I don't know why they have to run to the back. But when the bomb does go off, they're still mid jump, and they show it from a wide angle. The explosion, the shockwave causes like, I wouldn't be surprised if it caused like a tsunami level event on the coast of Manhattan, because it's enormous.
It shattered windows in Brooklyn and Harlem for sure. It was the Death Star explosion, the shockwave.
Right. It really was.
Not the original George Lucas 1970. No, this is the special edition pyrotechnic shockwave. Yeah, no, these guys are, their internal organs are vaporized by the overblast pressure wave that hits them.
I mean, the bomb was designed to destroy gold bars to a point where they couldn't be easily retrievable, right? Like, it wants to pulverize these solid hunks of metal.
Yeah.
And these dudes are like 15 feet away from the explosion.
Yeah. You know, the other thing about the unfortunate fact about... Well, first of all, before I get to the somber stuff, also when they hit the water, they play this sound. It makes it sound like Godzilla is down there with them. Like they make this like tortured metal scream and kind of like fireball type of sound. But it sounds like the Godzilla, you know, coming for Willis and Jackson. Did you know that this film was released exactly 1 month after the Oklahoma City bombings in 95?
Wow. And they still released it, huh?
Yeah, because like they're you know, and I don't think they would nowadays, because there was a lot of similarities in the plot, like the fact that like it's not a you know, bi-liquid thing, but they had that fuel ANFO kind of bomb that they get in, and I guess there was like a big shockwave from that. It destroyed that Murrow building, like it scooped a big old thing out of it. But yeah, I when I found that out, I was actually, I guess not impressed, but surprised, because nowadays there's no question they would push that thing back at least a month. And I don't think it does anything, but it allows them to say, hey, we're being sensitive. Instead, like, I think Fox took out like these full page ads in New York Times and Vanity Fair defending the decision to.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Yeah, like, get over it, babe. I don't know exactly. I just saw like press about. I didn't see the actual release, but like, gosh, that seems like a bad look.
That's wild.
This is one of the gnarliest blown the safety situations I've ever seen. Like, Indiana Jones, Crystal Skull's got to be the worst example.
Yeah,
but yeah.
It's an S tier blown to safety. I would like to do a tier ranking of a tier list of blown to safety moments.
All the blown to safety moments. Yeah. Yeah.
That'd be fun.
Yeah. It's because I can't think of offhand all of them.
No.
Yeah. I wonder if there's a canonical list of blown to safety moments. It'd go to TV Tropes or something. I thought the lock picking scene was pretty gnarly. Like Bruce Willis taking that shard of steel cable out of his meat and then drop it into Samuel L. Jackson's hands, and all that stuff was pretty cool. I got a question for you. Do you know why they are using Johnny Comes Marching Home as... I don't.
Because I associate it with like children's songs. I know it's like a... It's got to be some kind of old military anthem, but
it's, I think so. Like, I guess in the other diehards, they also had a piece of classical music that they were using as a, it's called Let 'Em Off. Is that what you said?
Leitmotif is what I've heard.
Leitmotif. Thank you. And I didn't see any like reasoning for why this is, but this is John McClane returning to New York City. Johnny Come Marching Home again. Maybe.
Okay. All right.
That's the only thing I think of is Johnny's coming home again.
Sure.
The other thing I couldn't help but notice that what is not in the first Die Hard is Bruce Willis debuts this intense concentration face. that he deploys anytime, like if John McClane is feeling for a police junction box that he thinks is a bomb. If John McClane is trying to drop a needle into Samuel L. Jackson's hand behind, he deploys this, like, I can't describe it. It's like he stretches all of his facial muscles to max extent. So his mouth is wide open and an O, his eyes are super huge. He just looks like, it looks like in Mike Tyson's Punch Out when you land a critical hit and they're going like that, only frozen in place at the maximum. I don't know what it is and why, but like post this movie, you see it a lot. You see it in like The Fifth Element. I feel like this is maybe his, what was that? There's a Mad Dog and Glory that ruined Al Pacino, or is The Scent of a Woman?
It might have been Scent of a Woman. That was the hoo-ah stuff.
Yeah, he did a movie. It's like, well, it's like that. That's just going to be who Al Pacino is for the rest of that. That's going to just completely like, I feel like this movie is the thing that set Bruce Willis into this type of like over intense acting for some of these sequences. I don't know.
You're right, and it works. I don't think it's like bad, right? It's
no,
but it does become his hallmark.
Yeah.
I see him in certain scenes in this, and I'm like, oh, that's Corbin Dallas from Fifth Element.
Exactly.
And that was like, not the same year, was it?
95? No, that's 97. I think 97 is Fifth Element. Maybe 99.
Yeah, so definitely, yeah.
97, I saw
it kind of solidifying the what I think of as Bruce Willis. Because, like, I'm more familiar with Bruce Willis from the sequels to Die Hard and Fifth Element, stuff like that, because that's what I was watching as a teen.
Sure.
And then I went back and I watched the Die Hard. So, I mean, Die Hard came out when I was a kid, a very young kid, so I wouldn't have seen it.
Another sneaky problem of this film is it's the hour 40 minute mark until John McClane goes full John McClane mode, stripped down to his wife beater, bloodied, cut. He's still got his shoes on, which is distressing. I felt like that we've got this correlation where like the Die Hard gets better inversely proportionate to how well Bruce Willis looks.
Yeah.
How well he's dressed and how his flesh is faring in the film. And I feel like, yeah, it took way too long to get to the good Die Hard moment in this film.
And I feel like he doesn't get as beat up in this movie as he does in some of the others, right?
It's true.
Or at least you're right. He doesn't spend as much time beat up in this film.
What is the point? What's the point in the, like, elaborate cuckolding plot that's going on between Jeremy Irons, his severe e-skirt and German girlfriend, and the one ideologically pure soldier guy that they end up killing, that Bruce Willis beats to death with a chain?
I don't know that there is a point. I mean, he betrays the guy, right?
Yeah, it's like a double betrayal. I read that McTiernan wrote that in there just because he's like, well, this movie's bloody enough to get an R rating. We might as well throw in a sex scene. Like, that's the worst reason to do anything. That, like, well, also, the rating's there, so we might as well have an awkward sex scene between... We might have Jeremy Irons and this German pop singer hate fuck in their Canadian warehouse.
Yeah, we can have Sonya from Red Alert 2... hate fuck this fake oil man. It's weird too, because it doesn't last very long, right? It's not like an important scene in their relationship or anything, and it's not even done artfully. I don't know. I've seen, like, if it was something like Top Gun, okay, maybe, like, at least that sex scene is done artfully, but this is just like wham bam on to the gold again.
No thank you, ma'am. Yeah. Do you want to hear the shocking story of the development of this film that I think sheds some light into some of its structural problems?
Yes.
This tale involves Steven Seagal, Brandon Lee's death, and about 24 Hollywood writers. So in the late in 89, 90, they were developing another sequel to Die Hard. And like most of the film, the premises of the Die Hard films, that they repurposed this from a standalone project. We talked about that in Die Hard, Die Hard 2. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, 20th Century Fox got in the idea that the third Die Hard should take place on a boat. And they're developing this project where McClane and his wife are on vacation. And they're taking a Caribbean cruise and terrorists take over their boat and threaten to blow it up. They hired this guy, W. Peter Iliff, who had just been hot off of Point Break in 91, which turned out to be a huge hit. Nice. He started reworking the script titled Troubleshooter. But since it wasn't written to be a Die Hard film, they kept on having to rewrite it. They had to add more action scenes. And he was in a second rewrite of this when Fox alerted him to this project called Dreadnought that Warner Brothers developed that Steven Seagal was attached to. That movie would later be called Under Siege.
Oh,
and you'll recall that we had a little bit of this discussion Under Siege plot. So they rewrote this thing three different times to make sure that Die Hard wouldn't be confused to this Dreadnought project. And then Fox decided, like, well, ultimately, you got two action guys trying to save a boat that's being taken over by terrorists. There's just no way we can release this in the same year. So scrap all this and rewrite it fresh. Hmm. And the other thing is, like, they also bought another script called Super Tanker as a part of this process to shelve it, just to make sure there's not three guys on a boat that's being taken over by terrorists.
Wow.
I'm thinking of, like, all the money that they spent into pre-production on this thing. So between 93 and 94, at least three more versions of Die Hard 3 have been written, all of them very different from the others. The first was written by John Milius, who wrote Apocalypse Now and wrote and directed Conan the Barbarian and Red Dawn, which took place in a jungle. There's one written by Doug Richardson. It took place in L.A., the L.A. subways that were taken over by terrorists who were actually trying to rob the L.A. Federal Reserve. And a second by John Fasano, which took place across the entire city of New York, where McClane chases kidnappers who took his teenage daughter as a hostage, mistaking her for some daughter of a rich industrialist. They get that, and they decide that both these scripts are hackneyed, like rehashes of previous Die Hard stuff, so they cancel all that stuff. The Die Hard in the Jungle, though, fascinated Bruce Willis to the extent that he kept on having it developed and developed, and it eventually became a project that you might remember, Tears of the Sun.
Oh, yeah, totally.
So that didn't end up getting, and that was going to be loosely the plot of Die Hard 4 until Fox rejected that, and then Bruce kind of like spun it off into his own little thing. Brandon Lee died on the set of The Crow, so that took that made Fox take another spec script called Simon Says by Jonathan Hensley, which was supposed to be Lee's next film, and suddenly it doesn't have a star, so they decided to change that, which eventually became Die Hard with a Vengeance. The original script is about a mad bomber who wants revenge against a police detective, and the only help he has is a shop owner who becomes involved by accident. Supposedly the first hour of this film is a word-for-word rendition of that particular script, which is why I think it holds together so well. Mm-hmm. And here's like the other thing is Warner Brothers, as they go back, Warner Brothers tried to buy that to make it into Lethal Weapon 4, but 20th Century Fox outbid them.
Huh.
This script went through at least a dozen rewrites by at least five different writers, focusing on problems in the second half and the ending. At one point, Zeus became a female, and they attached Angela Bassett to play it. And then after they filmed this film with its original ending, which I guess you can see in the DVD and Blu-rays, where McClane doesn't track him down to the north of the border location. And instead, it takes place months or even years after the film, where McClane has tracked this guy all over Europe. And he sets up this Russian roulette situation where he's got a Chinese rocket launcher where he's taking the sights and the trigger off of it, so you can't tell which end is the front, which end is the back. And he spins it between as he's tormenting Gruber, and he's playing his game called McClane Says. And he forces Jeremy Irons to blow himself up with this rocket launcher.
I love that ending. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly. They say the reason they rejected is because number one is anticlimactic. You got this balls of the wall action film and it comes to this short talky scene at the end with the rocket launcher. And also they thought it made McClane too vindictive, you know, that he's killing people, not in self-defense, but just for vengeance. But
yeah,
I think the end of this film is a mess. Like, he gets this aspirin bottle that's stamped with a Canadian truck stop that I guess Gruber is using as the base of his gold stealing terrorist operation.
Apparently.
And they launch a joint Canadian American assault on this facility. It turns into a helicopter chase. And the end of this film, I think I actually like the original rocket launcher ending the better. It sounds like that was cooler.
I think it would be cooler. But I understand the objections too, right? It doesn't necessarily climax the way you want it to, but I would have laughed out loud at that scene.
Yeah. I'm trying to also think, like, how the hell do you modify a rocket launcher where you literally can't tell which end is the I just removing the sights, and I don't know.
After watching Commando and knowing like how strange rocket launchers are set up in the first place, where like the end you think is probably forward is actually backwards.
Right.
I just love the idea that you could modify it to even professionals, even
like a German East German soldier had no idea. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I love it. That there's something very meta about that.
What else you got to talk about? I'm about out of, Die Hard with a Vengeance material.
I mean, I have to ask you before. Well, first of all, let's go back over to Jeremy Irons real quick. He plays an unconventional villain in this. I see a lot of villains eating apples. Jeremy Irons chose the rarely chosen hard-boiled egg. I don't know if that made him in Jeremy Irons' mind, if that makes him look intimidating.
Well, it makes his farts intimidating. I wouldn't want to be in the same room as this guy after he's eaten nothing but hard-boiled eggs all day, for sure. That's right? Some sulfurous shit coming out of your ass cheeks.
Let alone at sea, and it's all, you know, jostling around. And
oh, yeah. It's getting stirred and mixed. And
yeah, nothing good's coming out of that.
Some seasickness laid on top of it. Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah. Your risk of being blown to safety.
There's a binary liquid forming in his colon that, if it mixes, is going to wipe out and half the eastern seaboard.
Egg yolk. Here's the perennial question that I have to once again ask. Is Die Hard with a Vengeance a Christmas movie?
I had this in my notes, too.
Let me put the evidence on the table so we can all look at it. There's a kid on the bike who tips John McClane off to the fact that something's happening with the cops being drawn away or something. And he says, when he encounters John McClane, it's Christmas, you could steal City Hall. Okay, that's exhibit number one. Exhibit two, John McClane in the tunnel scenes that you were talking about, when he's trying to get near a truck to kill him, he's talking some mad smack about Santa Claus being on the loose and the cops trying to find him.
Yeah. Hey, buddy, I hear there's a guy with eight reindeer and a fat red suit. Pow, 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 pow. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of recognizable. Surprised you didn't see him or whatever. It came through here. Mm-hmm. Does that a Christmas movie make? Because it's the only two things I can find in this movie.
It's a damn shame. And in the Aaron director's cut, where he excises the tunnel scene, it definitely would not be. I feel like we've talked about this before. To be considered a Christmas movie, you have the bare minimum. There has to be a Christmas song and there has to be Christmas decorations. Like, it doesn't have to be about the literal, you know, like some people are purists. Like, it has to be, it's got to be like goddamn Elf. It's got to be about Christmas and about family celebrating and gift giving. I think it has to be, you have to have visible Christmas decorations and at least one Christmas song. And by that count, this movie fails. But I thought it was a bogus idea to just shoe the format. Just keep them all. Just John McClane has the worst Christmases of all time.
Yeah, it would have been great.
This movie is vastly improved by snow, by Christmas mm-hmm. decorations and by a few Christmas songs playing in the background, I think.
I agree. A Christmas riddle or two, right? Instead of
what a Christmas trilogy you'd have
with seven cats and sacks. It could have been seven reindeer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just
three wise men plus the, sure. Yeah, I think it would have been a better movie and it would have been an epic Christmas trilogy that you could watch every year.
Yeah, I agree. And one of the criteria is, like, in my mind, is does the plot have anything to do with Christmas, right? It's not necessarily like it has to be on Christmas, but it has to be something that, like, this couldn't really happen unless Christmas were involved. And that doesn't live up to that bar either.
Yeah, you're a little bit harder core on that than I am, because I just require the presence of music and decorations. Because mm-hmm. as like I said, the First Blood Christmas movie.
Sure.
Catch Me If You Can, unambiguously a Christmas movie. This, a couple of references to reindeer and a fat man in a red suit and stealing things like being on Christmas, I don't think it gets there. And yeah. I'm pretty lax. But anything else?
No, I think that's about it.
That wraps up our coverage of the often underlooked or overlooked second C charisma, epitomized here by Bruce Willis playing John McClane. Hope you've enjoyed our coverage of the badass of our badass coverage thus far. Of course, we're not done. We have one more badass movie to unveil next week, and also this Wednesday we'll be hosting another badass stream session where we're going to be considering new candidates, new inductees into the Badass Hall of Fame, and debating their worthiness live on Twitch and YouTube at /baldmove respectively at 1 p.m. Eastern starting this Wednesday. So if you want to join us there to give us your suggestions for badasses, that's the place to do it. Hope to see you there. Hope to see you back next week for the conclusion of our summer badass series 2022. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.